Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's me.
And Brian Killer of VI Linen, Vladimir Laden, Linneman, Vladen, Aladdin, Linen, Brian Brushwood, alternate universe, Brushwood.
It's true. Sorry. I killed Aladdin. Just put that on right. My gravestone.
Let's try to say VI and then Aladdin at the same time, and it really sounded a lot like Aladdin.
What is it? Vladimir Ilyinich Ulyanov?
Yeah, something like that. And you murdered him. So that's what happened on Weird Things and Journey Quest. But that's neither here nor there. On After Things, this is the show where you guys send us in your questions and thoughts and, you know, queries about developing stuff as a independent creator, an entrepreneur, whatever, and we give you our take on it. We're just a couple of guys trying to figure things out for ourselves, so don't take what we say as the gospel, because sometimes we're kind of idiots. So let's start off with this email from Fitz. It says, I know of a mailing list and other ways to self-promote yourself as a brand. All of you being entrepreneurs and how to promote yourself regularly, what's your suggestion to best promote the brand, which is yourself or myself to be particular? And if Jury says, just keep writing, please Photoshop a ghost beard behind him. Thanks for your time, Fitz.
Fitz is awesome. He's here in the chat room now, but he'll periodically ask me my advice. I mean, God knows why he would want my advice as a writer. But he asked me about, you know, what he should do. And literally the answer every time is to keep writing. Like, whatever you need to do to keep writing, keep doing it.
I'm going to put in, you know, my new take on things, which is think about the transmissibility of your idea or the content or what you're doing. You know, I started writing novels 6 years ago. Some of those novels have sold really, really well. Some of those novels have done okay. They've all gotten good reviews. And some of the books I thought were great books didn't move as well as other ones. And I've tried to evaluate what that is. Part one, there is algorithmical magic. There's just that you sometimes you luck into things getting discovered in front of people, which is hard to control, but you can sort of steer for. The other factor I thought of when I started thinking about things in general, what are things that I told my friends, you should check this out? And they go, oh, okay, sounds cool, but I wasn't able to transmit that idea to them. And I had a perfect example because I was on the phone talking to my dad and, you know, recommending like things on Netflix. And there's a TV show that I've recommended to several people. I don't think it's I think it's solid. It's an interesting show. It's a very interesting time period. But part of the problem with this TV show is the title of the show. It is not easy to remember. It's hard to articulate it. People have to ask you to repeat it a couple times. And the likelihood that they're going to forget that is super, super high. And that is Halt and Catch Fire. Which have you watched this show?
I've watched the first matter that I would love of it, and I love them.
Yeah, Brian, Justin.
No, I haven't. It's something that I would love, but I've just never gotten around to watching it.
Yeah. So the premise is that it's about the computing industry. It starts off the early 1980s and sort of follows the birth of like a company in Texas trying to build their IBM clone. And, you know, it loosely parallels real events, but they do their own. They have their kind of different figures. They have their kind of charismatic Steve Jobs figure. They've got the engineer type. They've got kind of the programmer hacker personalities. And it involves each year it kind of covers a different thing. So the episode season two was sort of about an online CompuServe type like network. Season three, you know, got into kind of like the late 80s as these things were becoming bigger. And then it ends. Well, I won't tell you where it ends. World Wide Web. So anyhow, it's a very interesting show. I think the problem is like the Cameron, the girl programmer character who's, you know, start off kind of interesting. I think she's thoroughly unlikable in the show and that they don't realize how unlikable they've made her to be. And that's problematic for the show, I think. But ultimately, it's a neat show. The problem is communicating the show. The name one is Halt and Catch Fire, which is some archaic computer term I never heard of until the show came out. And then I try to describe, oh, you should check out Halt and Catch Fire. Halt and what? Halt and this? And kind of like, never mind. Never mind. Staying on AMC, maybe you might like it. Books. I've talked about this before. Harry Potter, part of the success. That was a book that got turned down like 40 times, but finally it caught on and it succeeded. Part of the reason was is you can explain succinctly what it is. 10-year-old kid discovers a wizard, gets to go to a wizard school. 10-year-old kid has to fight this great evil wizard that's coming back. You can break it down into small digestible chunks and pitch it to people. Twilight, high school girl finds out her boyfriend is a vampire. Like, ooh, you know, these things are very easy to transmit. More complicated things can be more problematic. Sometimes an idea can have so much momentum, though, it'll carry over and carry through, or it gets into some sort of, you know, you could have a sci-fi book, and if it gets picked up and promoted, you know, back in the 1950s or 60s in analog or whatever, everybody's going to read it, and you'll get enough inertia that'll take over the fact that the name is hard to pronounce. You know, a great movie that's actually getting a sequel, though, they renamed was Edge of Tomorrow, Kill Again, whatever, the Doug Liman, Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt movie.
Live, Die, Repeat.
Yep. It went through multiple title names to the point that I still don't, when I have to go like, oh, you should, it's called, and I love the movie, and they renamed it multiple times in after it even was released, trying to say this is what it's called. So now it's Edge of Tomorrow, which sounds like a Bond movie name, which is dumb, you know, because you see right there, you look Edge of Tomorrow, you look at the poster.
What's, the initial name was All You Need Is Kill.
The store story, yeah. And you look at the poster, if you look at the poster on the IMDb page, and what is the first thing you see there?
Yeah, Live, Die, Repeat in larger font than the title.
Yeah, so when it comes back to Fitz's question, if you're saying, okay, I'm writing, I know I need to do, I know that, shut up, jury. I know I need a mailing list to tell people what I want to do. Certainly making sure that people know about what you're doing is important. Being able to say, hey, new post up. I have this happen a lot of times. People are like, man, I didn't know you had a product. I'm like, I sent out an email. I did a Facebook ad. I put it on Twitter. What more do you need me to do? People still say, well, I want to know. And there's maybe solutions to that. Making sure people get the word out, but also just making it transmissible. That's why shorter content can be better, shorter, more succinct. People who do long form think pieces, there's not a lot of that doesn't make its way around the web. Like shorter, more, oh, this is punchy, I like this. This is punchy, I like it. Shorter increases the number of people who read it, increases the likelihood people repeat it. Headlines that tell you what they're going to read. So much of our discussion online about blog posts and stuff, people are only reacting to the headline, which is problematic because you get into the comment section like, well, I think blah, blah, blah. Like, did you get past the first paragraph? You know? So that's my thought.
Well, there's some level of us that wants to blame the viewer for actually not reading the rest of it, but also it's not their job, right? And mm-hmm. So, for example, on the Scam Stuff site, we're currently working with our team to explain that, and by we, I mean we and whatever. Like, it's important that every second somebody spends on the site not waste any of their time. Don't tell me a story where the big payoff is at the end. Don't bury the lead. Like, just get right to the point. This is what you care about. Here's a problem that you have. Here's a solution that we have. Here's the one-time only deal that we're offering for you. I don't know. I feel like people have a tendency to get too clever by half when they put stuff out there.
Agreed. I think that a lot of people who are aspiring bloggers or tech people, and I don't know what you write and what you do, but I think a lot of problems is they're saying the same thing everybody else is saying. You know, like my take on, you know, like I'm going to give you my take on the Nintendo Switch. Okay. I can go to Verge. I can go to a lot of places to get this, you know, and other than it being your take, and I don't mean you personally, but other than being your take, what value are you presenting? Are you a game designer that can say, my take is going to, I'll tell you about how hard the tools are to work with or whatever. So many people want to do this because they see other people doing it. But the problem is then you're not adding anything. You're competing with a thing that's already been doing it and doing it better. So you need to think about your tank or your angle and whatnot. And it's easier. It's very easy to start with a particular point of view that's a very narrow point of view, but a narrow point of understanding on it, and then expand in much bigger as your audience grows than it is to try to appeal to everybody and try to build an audience.
And I think part of it in general is always just understanding that like Andrew said, you are, you know, Brian made a point about people not reading the things. It ain't their job. That's right. It's yours. It's your job to make people care about you. And it's your job to understand that people create part of the happiness for people to read a blog or to listen to a podcast is regularity. You know, once you become attached to somebody's writing or somebody's voice, it hurts when it's not there, whether or not you realize it. Like, you don't, in your head, you're not like, oh man, it sucks, they're not there. But you begin to trust them a little bit less. You know, you begin to trust them a little bit less if they're not there at moments that the reader thinks you should be there. So try to be as empathetic as possible to your readership and think about what would delight them. What would make them happy that you were covering or exploring or dissecting? And right. You know, just to go back one more time to Andrew's point, effort. It's the only currency on the internet. You can't make it anything else other than what it is, which is just putting in the time and the effort to research and present something.
And another thing too is I think that a mistake a lot of people make when they start something is they have no idea what the actual market for this is. I had a very good lesson in market share when I started writing magic books a billion years ago, because I had been told by two different people that the average magic book, hardcover book, would sell at least 300 units. That was the number of people who collected and would buy anything that came out to add to their collection. There were 300 people out there that did that. And that fluctuated. It was roughly 300. And that was actually to be a pretty stable number. Out of all the people that loved magic, of all the people that read magic magazines, all the people who bought stuff, 300, you could at least do 300 copies of something. So I built a publishing business entirely based upon breaking even at 300 units, because I knew if I could had a guarantee of moving 300 units, I did that. And that's why I never lost money with a book. And I, when DVDs and all that became out there, I expanded into that. People often say, I want to do a blog about my local community. Great. How many people live in your town? 18,000 people. Okay. What percentage of them will even read stuff and care? And it's not going to be 50, it's not going to be 40, it's not even going to be 1%. You're talking at a fraction, and you got to compete with everything else to do that. And a lot of times people say, I'm going to go do this. Like, okay, the number of people interested in this is very, very small, very, very small. There's a finite number of people here. Two, you're competing with everything else that's out there. And people often say, hey, you know, I think I want to do this thing, but yeah, maybe you got 30 people who will read you a week. Maybe that's the maximum number of people that are interested in that topic. I've seen that. I've had ideas and things I loved, and I'm like, this is just too obscure. This is just too narrow for what I want to do. Now, I could take something slightly less narrow that might have sideways appeal and build out from there, but, you know, that thing by itself, that might be it. What is the market, you know? And then, you know, I've looked at, you know, I've seen successes of people who start with, I'm going to cover one particular thing and I'll extend out there. Now, like Justin has been doing a thing covering books on politics, right? Now, that could be if Justin's writing reviews of political books and doing a blog that's on these reviews of political books, that could be a starting point to say, hey, I'm going to review all the latest books on politics. Anybody who covers politics, any blog or whatever like that, could look at that and go, oh, this is interesting. I need to check his reviews because I'll get a good recap of what this book is about. If Justin then said, I'm going to interject some commentary every now and then, the people who go there from the political books might be cool with that. They're like, oh, yeah, no, this is good. I've gotten out of some blogs, I don't need to mention, when they've done really, really good coverage of a topic and then they go off topic into politics. Cause I'm like, they're like, man, and you know, really, you know a lot about the Mac ecosystem, the Apple culture. You're politically as ignorant as anybody else I know. And reading your articles about this is painful and makes me lose respect for you. So not because I disagree with you, but because you just have fundamental lack of understanding the other points of view, whatever. I'm no longer going to go there. And that's a danger. So, but you can expand. Start with a thing you do well, expand out there, and that's a way to build your brand. Your brand is what you do, not what you say you do. And I'll give you an example of that. Is the thing that's been epiphany for me is Amazon's super successful. Jeff Bezos is on path to become the richest man in the world, right? Do you know what he defined the Amazon brand or what they were back in the 1990s? Anybody remember this?
Oh, geez. I would imagine he said, books on a river. That's why it's called Amazon.
Pretty much. It's customer service. He said Amazon's business model was we were in the customer service business, which meant that they said, how are we going to make our money? We're going to make our money by making people we deal with, interact with, happy. And our customers are going to be everybody. So that meant, well, if we're selling them books, we want to make them super happy. How do we make them happy? We give them a good selection. Then that. We give them a good price. We'll try to beat the best price, try to come close to it. We'll try to do that. Then we'll get the book to them as fast as we can. And then when you get the book or you get whatever, you're not happy with it, we'll make it really easy to return. These are all these points that are critical to us in order to make money through customer service. And Amazon did that. Remember the competitors back then, buy.com and these other people that tried to do it. And there was like, Barnes & Noble's getting into the book business, guys. You're doomed. You're doomed. What did Barnes & Noble know about online book delivery? Zero. What did Barnes & Noble know about customer service and stuff outside of their stores, which maybe didn't always have the best customer service? Zero. And that's why Barnes & Noble did not succeed in that market. When everybody said, they're going to take over, they're going to dominate, they weren't in the right business. Amazon said, we're in the customer service business. Now I'll give you another example, though. A company can say, this is our business, but that ain't what they ended up doing because that's not where they made their money. Google, what did Google say their mantra was or their business was?
Don't be evil.
Yeah, don't be evil. Organizing the world's information.
Right.
All right. What's the profit model on that? Well, you know, advertising. Your business is advertising, guys. You can say your job is to organize the world's information. We've talked about this before. What happened to Google Books? You know, there's like two people on that now. What happened to some of these other really ambitious projects to organize? They want no money in that, so you didn't do it. You didn't pursue it the way you could have. There was a lot of money in selling advertising to people and doing highly targeted ads. So Google is the world's largest advertising company. They can call themselves whatever they want, but you know, we're not their customers. You know, we're their inventory. You know, we're the commodity. And that's right. You know, Microsoft said, you know, Microsoft, Bill Gates says, I want to see Windows on every single computer. And he said, I'm going to get market share, market share, market share, market share, market share, market share, at a point where it was the product was easy and cheap to produce and he could reduce the cost, whatever he needed to do. He could sell Windows licenses at $3 a pop and still make a profit. That's what they did. And that succeeded when that was critical important. Apple said, we're going to make hardware, we're going to make software. And initially, that was great. In the 90s, when hardware prices fell a lot, Apple suffered. Apple suffered a lot, but then when hardware prices sort of kind of plateaued and Apple said, well, we can improve the quality and we can provide a layer of service to it, then Apple succeeded. And that's, you know, and as a brand, news agencies and all this, newspapers run into this problem because like our business is giving people the news. No, your business is selling advertising. Your business is selling advertising. And now the New York Times is trying to shift to a subscription model. And they're looking like they're having some success, but you know, they're a shadow of themselves when they were the only game in town when it came to advertising. So what is your business? That comes down to it.
Well, so where do we universalize this as far as like folks at home, as far as the takeaway? Well, like what's the home lesson on this?
I think let's go around and say, Brian, what is your business? Justin, what is your business? And I'll get into my business. Okay.
Man, I'll tell you what, my business is basically to sell, and this sounds really weird to say out loud, my business is to sell the possibility. I'm not going to say the fantasy because the fantasy would imply that it's not entirely possible for every single person, but my business is to sell the possibility of you being the most interesting person in the room, whether that is by knowing a bunch of card tricks, by knowing a bit about mind reading, whether it is by being the most informed person in the room when it comes to the changing world of cord cutting and watching what you want on Netflix, Amazon Prime, and Hulu and so on, whether it is feeling like you're one of the lucky ones who got to be in the room while you watched a guy eat fire, stick a nail in his eyes, do a straitjacket escape and so on. My whole business boils down to you are awesome and special, and I will go out of my way to empower you to be and feel like those things, and I hope you feel like throwing me some nickels as a result.
Okay, I'm gonna critique that.
Go for it.
And one of the ways that you can define to say what your real business is you can say, if X does not happen, do I still have a business? Okay. If advertisers still paid Google money, Google would still succeed, even if nobody used their products. If advertisers paid Facebook money, Facebook would still succeed. And so they can say, we're trying to do X, but as long as those people give you money, your business succeeds. You know, a flower can say, man, my job is to be a rose. I need to be beautiful. I need to be loved. There ain't no sunlight. You ain't doing that. You do a couple businesses. Okay. Now those are the hooks. The hook, that's why you bring people in. But people can say, man, Brian empowers me. Brian does this. Brian does that. But if nobody pays for YouTube advertising, that part of the business don't exist.
Well, but I think that is a testament to why I'm so highly diversified.
Yes.
Specifically, like, you know, there's a number of people who have reached out to me on Twitter saying, like, hey, man, aren't you freaked out over the fact that YouTube is not paying this person, not paying that person. There was a random hiccup glitch where the King of Random site showed up as having been terminated. Because
that was random.
Because some robot shut it down. And luckily it turned out to be a mistake and he's back up and running. But like the fear of that has me highly, highly, highly diversified. In the beginning, there was the stage show, and from the stage show begat the opportunity to reach out to more people through Scam School.
I'm going to interrupt you for sure. The stage. Your diversification is a great example to people of like, hey, don't do have this one thing because these platforms change and you can have the rug pulled out from you overnight. Your stage show, who was the consumer?
It became college audiences, which was a very specific audience.
I'll interrupt you. Who bought it?
College campus activities boards, a small group of like eight people who decided who would come to campus each year.
And that's the thing to get to is it's like, and they wanted, if you please the audience, obviously that, but that was, and that became, that's the, that you realized, man, I have a great show. I can entertain people, but these people who are the ones writing the check, I have to get through their narrow minds and they think they're experts on this stuff, but they're only having this position for 2 years and they want to be these little lords and lordettes and stuff. And that's frustrating for a lot of people. It's like, my business is doing great shows. I do great shows. But actually a big part of my business is I got to sell that group of people on this.
And that's the tough thing is like, people think that if they're a magician, and I'm sure you can extrapolate this to whatever it is you want to do creatively, people run into the mistake of thinking that the thing they create is the product. That is, it is the product, but that's not how you make your money. You make your money by selling the product. You are a salesman of a product of your own devising.
Yeah. And so you've taken each of these lessons and you've expanded on that. You looked at like, hey, I can only be in one place at one time performing for college audiences. If I do, let's say, Scam School, I can be in front of infinite number of people can watch this show and can do this. And so it's not like that show, like a live show that's done and it's gone forever. This is a show that lives on and you still make income from shows you did 10 years ago. Okay.
Correct.
Then you looked at, correct, you said, okay, I've got an audience here and I know this YouTube income is highly variable. One quarter away from Google saying, let's decrease the payments we give out to people so we can increase our profitability from saying, hey, my nut just got severely impacted. I need to diversify. What do I have? I have a large audience. So besides depending on advertising income, I have their attention. I can sell my own stuff and I can do my own thing via scam stuff, right? So,
right. And correct. Well, in the case of scam stuff, it was a complementary thing. Like, what can I do that in no way negatively affects Scam School, but instead picks up all of the brand value that is being, you know, spilled over? Because only so many people watching Scam School want to buy a domain at any given time. Yeah. So meanwhile, like there's this general aura of positivity. How can I, you know, reach out to those people and figure out something that's worth it for them? And so that's where scam stuff comes from.
Yeah, you realize that the one advertiser that could take that had the best fit and it made the most sense to capitalize on that audience was you if you provided products and brand.
Right. So, which, by the way, was never my intention. When we started Scam School, I was like, hey, this will be fun. It'll help me get shows and so on. But instead, there reached this point where it's like, hey, man, all these advertisers, they're spending money just to get their message across. Here I am with an IP that I don't necessarily own, but I do, you know, control. what if I figured out how to provide something that would be of value to everybody who watched and then might make me a buck along the way? And it seems to have worked out pretty well.
So, Justin?
Yes.
In your various enterprises, how would you describe?
My business is, I would say, I mean, you know, the way that I make my money primarily is through Patreon, which is through the shows. So, you know, and then with sidelines for guest shows and the stickers and stuff like that and the card game. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, everything kind of drives through the idea of kind of being a community organizer.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that, like, you do shows that are niche shows that don't have huge amounts of audience, but the amount of revenue you generate from that is outsized because of the loyalty between that audience and you that is very valuable for them to see this thing continue. And so they take it upon themselves to support and keep the thing going. You're selling your product to an audience. You're selling your product to an audience. You're not in an advertising business. You're not ad supported. Your ad dollars come. So that's the product you're selling, is these things you do and people paying for that directly. It's on YouTube, but it's not an ad based model.
Yeah.
And I guess my point of bringing these things up is that, like, we have several different examples of where Brian, in some cases, like, one of the things that happened that caught people off guard was you get internet companies would say, okay, we have a lot of eyeballs. We have a lot of attention. What's our business? They say, okay, well, advertising. A lot of them went to the agency model and they said, okay, we're going to go to ad agencies and we're going to do $5 million campaigns and $10 million campaigns, which sounds kind of cool initially. But the problem is your business then becomes, you have to keep hiring more and more ad people and cycle through them, because you're in the same trap that traditional media was in trying to come up with new campaigns. Google said, we're going to build a robot. You go to the robot and say, I want to spend $5. The robot helps you spend $5, and it tries to use that money as efficiently as possible. Where the ad agency model is, that ain't about it. They don't want it. They're not going to promise. They'll tell you they're going to give you efficiency, but they cannot count on efficiency because they're hugely inefficient. And that's why internet companies that were really dependent upon those ad agency models, like a lot of blogs and stuff, why they failed, because the problem was the number of, you know, the value of attention kept falling faster than they could try to sell whatever inventory they had or raise the prices on inventory. So Facebook followed the Google model. We're going to sell. It's digital. Just go in there, tell the robot what you want. It's the challenge of an ad model. You know, and Brian, you know, as his audience has increased and audience has grown, it says, okay, not just going to be dependent upon the ad model. I'm going to have these other models to do that. And Justin, in this model of, hey, I'm going to do a niche thing, but I'm going to really cater to these people so much that they will pay for this thing to be there. They would rather it exist than not exist. That's what Weird Things does too.
Well, yeah, and that's one of those things where it's like, there's no right or wrong answer. There's what you're comfortable with. And I would say that everything I've done has been driven on the fear. The moment I quit my day job in 1999, part of the reason I quit my day job is because I realized I was in a position that I could be fired by someone else for reasons that either were or were not justified. And that horrified me so much that my life's mission for the next 25 years has been to make sure I'm in a position that I have so many bosses that if any chunk of them fired me, it would be viewed as a momentary loss or as a specific, you know, downshift in revenue from one segment or the other. In general, it's allowed, on the one hand, it has created in me this low grade constant terror that I'm not provided enough, that I'm not being honest enough, that I'm not sharing enough to the fan base. But on the other hand, it's also given me a real sense of security where when I have made mistakes, like, it's very rare that I can make any one mistake that will piss off 100% of my audience to the tune of stopping supporting me, whether through buying stuff, whether through supporting the advertisers, whether it's through watching the stuff and generating ad revenues or Patreon or whatever. And not that I'm on the hunt to go out and try to figure out a way to piss off that many people, but there does come a spiritual well-being from knowing that it's very unlikely that you could piss off that many people all at the same time.
If anybody can do it, though, Brian, I have faith. Yeah,
I'm working on it.
And that's, I find myself with this question because I'll go, on one hand, you know, I'll be like, man, my goal is to get a publisher to buy this book, you know? Mm-hmm. And then after the fact, it's like, my goal is to get people to read this book. And in one hand, it's that. And then it's like, oh, my goal is to get these people to buy this option for this book. And then, you know, you get into that and then, you know, you know, our TV show, it's like, my goal is to sell this to a, you know, if I can sell this show to a network, they'll pay me to do a series, you know? And then it's like, well, the longer term is I need to get advertisers to pay for this show and I need to, and to make them feel they got to do it, I got to hit X number of numbers or not. I mean, it's so many variables, and that's get to the heart of one, how can you make money and how do you want to make your money? And, you know, both, you know, Justin and Brian have done different things. Brian's done some stuff that was basically entirely ad supported. And then he's done stuff that is direct sales. And then he's done stuff that's Patreon supported. Justin, you know, Justin's been doing broadcasting for years, but very little of, you know, part of the income has come from ad sales, like direct ad buys, but not like directly YouTube stuff for the most part. Then you've done stuff that's customer, you know, people paying for that. And then that happened with a contender is you launched another product that said, you launched a product that's like, hey, my name's on this product. I made this product. If you like me, you will like this.
And as we will again on June 30th with Action News.
Yeah. And when you made money from blogging, it was because we did a niche, we did the magic niche, and we could go sell directly to, we knew who the advertisers or the people who were buying advertising. We didn't use Google AdWords or Google anything like that because, like, we won't make enough from that. But we know we have a much higher value. I had people like, why don't you guys do a Google AdWords? It's like, we're making thousands of dollars a month and not $6 a month off of that audience. Google AdWords undervalues that audience. And so that was, for us, that would be dumb to do that. You know,
the difference was the sweat equity of just getting out there and realizing that, you know, you can just go to the distributors. The distributors are going to list what magic tricks are coming out each week. And you email the creators because they're easy to find. They're all working magicians who have their emails out there publicly.
Yeah. Yeah. We knew how to reach them. We knew what that market. So the advantage of a small market was approachable. And so our chances of getting a yes was very high compared to just cold calling and doing that in another market. So It depends, and it's if people want to do things, but they don't understand how they're going to get fed doing them, and then they're not getting fed by it, and then they stop doing it. And sometimes it can take a long, long time, and that's been our big thing is perseverance. Persevere, make your idea transmittable, make it very easy for people to say, this is great, check out what this person did. And, you know, just have a, understand how the business of this works. It just, you know, I hear about a lot of things that, you know, people like startups like, oh yeah, we want to aggregate like reviews, this or whatever. I'm like, how's that different than 1,000 other things? And maybe you're better, but that's a market where you look at like sites that get hundreds of thousands of viewers a month. You know, if you're getting several hundred thousand viewers, readers a month for your blog, you're still not going to pay your bills. If you're using standard ad models, you're still not going to pay your bills.
Yep.
No. So,
well, this goes back to something that we've talked about repeatedly, where it's like the fantasy that every artist wants to believe, whether you're a musician, a magician, an actor, a performer, an impressionist, a balloon artist, it doesn't matter. Everybody wants to believe that it is possible that they can just be the artist and somebody else will take care of the financials. And that is a lie. It is a fraud. It is not true. It has never been true. And the faster you realize that you are the captain of your own artistic starship, the happier you're going to be.
Yeah, you got to accept that. And I mean, the side note is I get that every now and then people go, hey, I have an idea for a book. I'm like, that's great. And I'm like, why don't you write it? Like, I don't have the time, so it must not be a good idea. No, it's a great idea. Well, if you think it's a great idea, then you would write it, or would you take 2 weeks of vacation to go write it? Meh, no. All right. So you don't believe in it that much. And,
what's funny is I don't think that's an indictment of laziness. I think when people say that, what they're saying is they believe it's a good idea, but they don't believe that it's possible for them to apply themselves for 2 to 5 weeks to write it. And as a result, they believe it in it enough that they want it to be out there in the world, So what they do is the next best thing, which is tell it to other people and wish that they'll do it.
Yeah, but it's like, would you pay if it's going to tell, like, would you pay somebody to go write this for you? Okay, so that's you're not that sure about the idea, but you're right. It's like coding projects. You know, I would bother my friends like, hey, do you want to work on this thing? It could be really, really cool. Like, okay, you're asking me to spend 2 weeks of time on a project minimum, no pay. How much you because my time costs you nothing, so you're happy to say go do this. But the corollary is going to give to we get that all the time. Like, yeah, I just want to be an artist and do this. Everybody wants to do that. Everybody wants to do that. And if you want, but if I had a man, I get the magicians. Like, if I had a manager, yeah, that manager's managing more people who are worth more. That manager's out there representing somebody who's making money, not waiting for some lazy person to come along and say, hey, manage me.
No, yeah. No one's going to solve your problem. And even if you had somebody that was going to help you solve your problem, you are going to have to direct them exactly where you want to go and have a sense of what they are doing. Because the worst possible thing that you could have that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy is success when you have no idea how it's happening and there is somebody else that is involved financially. Like, that is... I mean, not only is that a quick way to kind of immediately nullify the financial success that you have, but also you don't have a clear path kind of even spiritually or artistically of what you're walking, you know, and what feels good and what feels bad. Like, there's just – you're in the woods. And I think it's that kind of stuff that I think drives, like, child actors crazy is that, like, mm-hmm. there's – all this stuff is happening around them and they have no idea really what it means or why it's there or why – what's – normal or abnormal about it.
Yep. Gentlemen, let's bring this to a close so you guys can go do the shows and whatever you got going on. Any last minute picks?
Hey, Silicon Valley, it's back and it's great. And I love this season so far.
My pick is going to check out Halt and Catch Fire. I think that's interesting. And my pick again from Weird Things is The Attention Merchants by Tim Wu, which so far I'm really enjoying. So I would...
You know what? I'm going to give a double down high five to The Leftovers on HBO because I watched both the second episode of American Gods and the third season, third or fourth episode of Leftovers. And I understand one of them is one that I've been more, emotionally invested with for a longer time. But I read American Gods and I'm going to say flat out, I think Leftovers, where it's at right now, is a more interesting story than where American Gods is.
Well, gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.